On November 19, 1942, a platoon of the Buff's 2nd Battalion with armored support met a similarly sized enemy force near Grid Square F5. This force came under heavy fire, its advance stalled, and they found themselves unable to retreat in the face of a more mobile foe. While the rest of the unit attempted to redeploy after their armored support was disabled by an enemy panzer, the attached artillery observer, Captain Charles McDougall, showed great gallantry in climbing an exposed hill and risking concentrated enemy fire in order to call in supporting artillery. Demonstrating great skill, Captain McDougall directed an extremely accurate bombardment on the enemy concentration. After action reports show that Captain McDougall's calm and clear-headed coordination of artillery fire resulted in severe casualties in the enemy's main infantry strength, including command elements of the enemy platoon. In recognition of his bravery and cool-headedness under fire, turning back a significant enemy thrust, he is recommended to be awarded the Military Cross. Hey everyone, this is Eric with a quick correction before we begin. During the episode, we mentioned that William Gott, Bernard Montgomery's predecessor for command in North Africa, was killed in an aircraft accident. This is actually not true. He was killed on the 7th of August, 1942, when his aircraft was shot down by two German fighter planes in supposedly secure airspace. We just wanted to make sure that that correction was made before we get on with the show.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Plastic Press Gang Podcast. Sorry for the delay. Life happened. My name is Calvin. I use he, him pronouns. And I had to write a paper up for this thing today. Y'all better be happy.
And I'm Eric. I also use he, him pronouns. And the reason we haven't recorded anything for about a month and a half is because I was making other people write papers for their degrees. And then I had to read them.
Oh, right. Actual adult job over here with Eric.
Yeah, I made two new doctors and in the process painted very little.
That's okay. That's a nice segue into the first part of the bookkeeping for today's episode, which we'll get to the idea here in a second, but y'all are going to like it. Well, actually, let's start with Eric. What have you painted since the last episode?
So I have painted very little. I have done a little bit of an experiment because I'm trying to do a black and white color scheme for the terrain and baddies for the Silver Bayonet, because I like this idea of it's sort of this noir, was any of this ever really real sort of feeling to it. I did a couple test models for that and didn't end up liking how they came out. I think I used too much gray. And so actually what I had is if I sort of went back and looked at some old Nosferatu vampire films and things like that. And the delineation between black and white in black and white movies is actually really sharp. There's not a lot of shades of gray. Also, having used sort of black and then a like darkish gray from 45 degrees and then a lightish gray from like 65 degrees and then white from straight up, it just came out looking basically like bare plastic again. And so I painted those and then took them all back to black primer. And we're starting again with those. Other sort of hobby-related stuff I have been doing is I have been not painting, but I have been printing up a storm. I got a new resin printer, a EPAX E1014KW is I think the number. I was going to buy a new 3D printer, and then I had been complaining for a while that essentially I love my old EPAX. I wish they made a new one, but they're falling wildly behind on the technology curve. And like I'd buy it if they caught up, but they just don't seem to. And then they basically went challenge accepted. And while I had a Saturn III literally in my shopping cart, I got an email that was like, hey, pre-order this new thing. And I was like, oh, this looks really good. And I have been enjoying that because I can print way more than I used to. And so it sort of opened up a lot of large format stuff, because what is really a burden for 3D printing, especially resin 3D printing, is when you've got the build plate and you have to take it off and you have to wash the miniatures, et cetera, et cetera. That's sort of a pain that scales really well by plate size, because like small plate, large plate, whatever, you have to put on gloves, you have to put it in the toxic goo, et cetera, et cetera. So that's been really nice. I've been printing a ton of stuff for sort of our upcoming attempt at doing some Normandy-related gaming in June. I've got 15 more telegraph poles. I have printed 8 linear feet of railroad track that a buddy of ours, Russell, is currently having trouble priming, so I'm sort of trying to debug that with him. I have printed a wrecked Panzer III, a wrecked Panzer IV, a wrecked Sherman Firefly. Waiting at the clubhouse for you is a wrecked Churchill III and a wrecked large caliber German anti-tank gun. Been printing out objective markers so that we can have sort of narrative objective markers, like observe, there is a fuel dump here or a telegraph station or something. That's been a lot of what I've been doing, is building terrain for that. I've been printing both sort of the terrain and the monsters I need for Silver Bayonet. I've got everything I need printed for the solo campaign for Silver Bayonet, and I'm sort of working on everything else. And then I'm going to switch over to Canada to do the same thing. Also, there's been a lot of that. And then I finally broke down, I haven't painted, I haven't even assembled it, but I finally finished breaking down the sprues for Warlord's Epic Pike and Shot starter set into the appropriate little plastic baggies of, this is all the pikemen, this is all the commanded shot, this is the cuirassiers, etc. That's step one in painting that. So gonna try to keep that momentum going. I do have to sit down now because I have gone from, oh, I've got plenty of time, to, uh-oh, it's the summer. I've got to figure out what I need to paint for Nova, because Nova is coming up relatively fast. And so what I'm working on right now is staring at my unpainted Sisters of Sigmar army that is, I believe, if not older than Calvin, dangerously close to it, because I have signed up for a Mordheim event. And I like the idea of using the classic old metal sculpts for that, but I've got to get those all set up. And then I bought a bunch of stuff, as is my way, and I've got to figure out how to store it all.
I mean, I know you picked up Blood and Plunder since the last time we talked.
I picked up Blood and Plunder. I picked up War Games Atlantic, I think. Whoever's doing the models that are supposed to support the Baron's War, I think it's War Games Atlantic.
Yeah, they are.
Came out with some Foot Knights. I bought a box of those because I heard good things about them.
Yeah, let me know how those go. I'm curious.
Yeah, they look promising. And then I picked up, there's essentially a baggage train for Epic Pike and Shot that I bought because I like the idea of being able to capture a baggage train. I think that's about it. Oh, and then I backed two Kickstarters.
Of course.
Empress Miniatures has their second round of Arnhem Heroes, which includes both the Polish Brigade and more British paratroopers. So I backed that. And then I also backed Footsore Miniatures, had a bunch of Vikings, and I bought an embarrassing number of Vikings. Because the Goonhammer Historicals channel has been talking up a storm about Saga, and I am passingly interested in that. Vikings are where Saga started, so might as well get into the core of that game.
Oh no, I guess I'll expand my Anglo-Saxons.
Yeah, really, drag you kicking and screaming into the Dark Ages.
I know.
It'll be a huge effort, I know.
Also, there's a funny thing where we didn't buy, even though we were both very interested in it, Punic Wars Rip.
Yeah, so the Punic Wars is really the only way to get me into Ancients. I sort of love Carthage. I did a bunch of like History Day, which is essentially history science fair stuff, on the Punic Wars when I was in like middle school. Love me some Hannibal, but
we don't $400 love.
$400 is a lot. And I say that rocking the Dueling Comes No Kid lifestyle, but it's still a lot. It feels like it will still be there come a Warlord Christmas sale, etc., etc. And in the meantime, I've got like 7 games worth of starter sets to work my way through already. If it had been less than that, I think I might have been like, okay, but I like tiny Spearmans. $400 was enough of a price shock to be like, yeah, maybe not. I'm in a very terrainy mood recently. Like, I've gotten really interested in the idea of having like really good, really detailed looking boards. And that has always been one of my issues with Ancients, is like most ancient battles were fought in relatively clear fields for very good reason. And so like, it's sort of contrary to my like, but I want a star fort in the middle of the battle and maybe a river. And then we have to capture a mill. And so I think that was sort of like, but I could be persuaded. And then when Warlord was like, it's $500 or $400, I was like, maybe not.
Also, for the record, Eric actually had a bad idea for me this time around.
I did.
With that Starfort that you showed me.
I did. I have found a 28mm 3D printable Starfort, and it now lives rent-free in my brain. Give it a month or so. for me to dig myself out of my current, like, literally there are boxes of miniatures everywhere in my office right now issue. Once I dig myself out of that, I think I might snap. I also asked him, in a justification to myself, I asked the creator, like, hey, does this scale well to like 15 to 10 millimeter? And he's like, oh yeah, it works great. And I'm like, cool, thanks.
That's all.
I'm gonna self-justify some stuff. I may take the plunge on that because I do like the idea of a proper Starfort. I've got one of the Sarissa Precision ones. It's fine. But it's not a fort. It's a star outpost.
It's a fortification.
Yes, it's a star fortification. It is an excellent, like, Pikeman's Lament or like something on the, like, if we did a like a on the frontier or something like that. It's a star fortification. The one I'm talking about is a proper star fort. And that's calling to me. So Calvin, he who paints faster and didn't spend an entire semester trying to get two graduate students out the door, what have you been up to?
So remember how I was talking about French last episode? And I said, that's probably going to be like a 2025 project. I lied. They're done now. They're based. The French are ready for whatever I want. A friend of ours was getting rid of some Italians very cheaply. And so I traded him some 15 mil terrain for Italians. Then I bought some Italians. And now I have an army of Italians for the desert. I painted a command vehicle for my Africa Corps. I painted a Crusader for my 8th Army. I painted a 25 pounder and a quad tractor for my 8th Army. I painted an anti-tank gun for my Africa Corps. I finally bought the Zulus that I've been wanting to buy so I could do Anglo-Zulu War. I painted a lot of the terrain and models for What a Stormtrooper that we ran that went very well. I built another SAS squad from some sprues I had lying around. I painted a martyr for my Africa Corps. I built a British Napoleonic skirmish force for Rebels and Patriots, sharp practice, whatever we want at that scale. I painted some of the metal O200 hours Germans for the Desert War. And in slightly less historical, I built some very short pikemen and bowmen, which are some of the Williams Atlantic halfling militia, because I had some sprues of them that I got from Russell, and I thought they would be fun to build and paint. So far, I'm correct.
That seems fun and would work well for like Dragon Rampant or something.
Yeah, or just screwing around in something, you know?
So that list prompts a question for me, which is, had we seriously not recorded an episode since we did What a Stormtrooper?
We have not, no.
Oh, that's embarrassing. So we should probably talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, well, that segues great into the games that we played.
Indeed.
So What a Stormtrooper is a project that Eric and I had been working on for a little bit. We'd mentioned it in some previous episodes where we took the wonderful Two Fat Lardies rule set, What a Cowboy, and we just cranked the Mandalorian theme as loud as we could during it and became What a Stormtrooper. As we live close to several college campuses, we want to recruit for it. We wanted a game that we could teach quickly, that would grab attention, and that would be fun to play.
And who doesn't love Star Wars? That was really the idea behind it, is like Star Wars is basically a cowboy movie, but with laser guns. That allowed us to dispense with some of the most complicated parts of What a Stormtrooper. Like, for the most part, we let people just ignore counting ammunition because everybody has blasters. Except the people who had shotguns, we made them count their ammunition. And generally speaking, you know, a gunfight over a town in the desert, whether you're wielding a Colt or a blaster, is largely the same. So what we did is we built four factions. We ended up only really ever using three of them. We had two just stone cold Mandalorian badasses. We had a group of rebels and the town sheriff, played by Timothy Oliphant. And we had three Stormtrooper remnants. So essentially the hard up guys on Tatooine who are wearing scavenged armor and things like that. We also had two Trandoshan bounty hunters. We did some playtesting with them. They're real hard to succeed with because they're actually not elite dudes. They've just got tons of gear, which means if one of them gets killed, you're largely out of the game. They have to get real close to start being dangerous. So that was sort of the, if Calvin and I need to play a force to lose, that's the force we'll play. the twist we had on this was we also had, because we have the figure, a little Grogu who started somewhere on the board and would wander around based on a scatter dice, which is the most powerful tool in any narrative gamer's arsenal. And if you shot at Grogu, shot over Grogu, got in a fight near Grogu, died near Grogu, etc., the Mandalorian would show up, pick up his charge, and blast his way out. He is an extremely elite character that is basically a full $150 gang in a single model. So generally speaking, what he'd do is he'd show up, completely obliterate whoever had just upset Grogu, and then he'd sort of fight his way off the board. Hilariously, this got triggered in three of our four games. Generally speaking, the games, I think, went really well. People picked it up very fast. It's a pretty intuitive rule set. We had a couple people who were very sort of interested in it and engaged in it. Calvin and I's favorite player was one young woman who joined with her friends and was just sort of curious. They had a little bit of time before an event they had to go to, and so they played. She figured that game out in about a turn and proceeded to just body her friends and just dismantle their armies.
It was fantastic.
That was just amazing to watch someone who had really never played this before be like, okay, but if I do this, I think I can kill both of them. And I was like,
yes,
you can. Roll them dice. So that was fun. I think we got a lot of people engaged in it. It made for a really good demo game, just because it's lightweight. Who doesn't love Star Wars? The teams were pretty balanced. There was never... the Mandalorians are harder to play than people think they are, but there was never a team where I was like, man, we need to...
completely
rethink this. That was one game that Calvin and I ended up at least refereeing about five of those.
Yeah. I will say, an interesting thing we learned about this game as well is it worked better with three people rather than just two.
Yeah, three people was really interesting. I was expecting that to be a problem because we had a lot of three-person groups that was sort of unexpected. The game worked better with three people, I think, because we were using pretty small gangs. And so if someone started to lose models, that would spiral pretty fast. But with three people, no one ever really let two people fight it out and then like close in on the loser. They tended to just all pounce on each other. So it sort of prevented that spiral because no one could really just like
hammer one group.
Spike a turn and just like hammer somebody into the ground. So that was actually really fun to see that.
And for next year, we have a few ideas. One thing we said was that we want some terrain with a bit more verticality on it. We only really had one piece or maybe two that made really good second floor or third floor things. And we have an idea for one more gang of poor, hapless New Republic fleet troopers getting bodied in the large numbers.
Yeah, where the answer to that is, what if I just spammed dudes with pistols? As an old person, I have a deep and abiding fondness for the poor guys who get utterly crushed guarding the entry to the Tantive IV over Tatooine, ripped to some real ones. And so I found some STLs for them. So I am going to print just a whole gang of just like dudes and see how that works, because sometimes that works really well and sometimes it's just a fiasco. And I'm super curious as to which is which.
So that was What a Stormtrooper. We're probably going to do it again next year. We'll probably do another we're probably going to have another episode where we talk about doing non-historical games with historical rules. That's another episode, though.
Yeah.
Other games we played. I played several games of Bolt Action for Teaching using my North Africa armies because they live in the same box, so I can grab them real quick. And I taught several games of Scouts Out, which is a World War I miniatures game. That's honestly really fun to teach and really fun to play. And it got people interested really quickly when I said, hey, you need 10 models and you get 30 for 35, you know?
Yeah. I've been super tempted by the STLs for that game because they have some really cool trench raiders.
Oh, yeah. No, I want some of them real bad.
I've been eyeing them.
It's the British Point Man model that I really want.
Yeah.
With the punch dagger.
I like him. I like the Frenchman with the just full face mask of chainmail.
There's some Kaiser too.
There's some great ones in there. There was that. I played a very large game of Adeptus Titanicus. I had arranged a 2,000 point game with one member of our club. Then somebody else was hanging around and was like, I would like a game too. And I was like, well, if I stick this War Master in the same box as everything else, I've got 3,000 points, and you two can both fight me. So our club is currently running a 40K narrative campaign. One of it was some Traitor Titans have attempted to force the main gates of the Hive City. Legio Astorum sallied out to defend them and completely crushed the traitors in a wildly lopsided battle that I still don't really understand how it happened. I killed 3,000 points of Traitor Titans in exchange for losing one Reaver and having another one badly damaged. Oh, and I lost two knights, but they don't matter.
Knights don't matter.
Essentially what happened is about once a turn, the War Master would look at a Warhound Titan and go, I don't like the look of you. And that would be the end of it.
He casts Die.
Yeah, he casts Die, and Warhounds go down fast if you start hitting them real hard. And importantly, unlike the Warlord guns, which are big template guns that can't be targeted, the super terrifying Titan-sized plasma cannons on that Titan can be. The other game I played is my first game of Battletech in probably two decades.
Crab Oil?
Yep, there was a discussion on our club website about a multiplayer game and how they should do that. And I was being a little bit cheeky and was a little bit drunk and suggested a mode called Crab Boil, which is one person is in either a crab or a king crab, and everybody else is in a mostly flamers and lasers light mech. And the goal is to kill the crab, preferably by overheating. And so my pilot, Jimmy the Clamps, was piloting a like fancy clan tech crab versus a bunch of flamers and lasers fire starters. And antics ensued. And it was just a hilarious game of everything you want out of Battletech. You know, jump shedding behind someone and saying, nothing personnel, kid, as you just obliterate them. One thing where we were standing on a wall because it was one of the arenas, the wall rose up and then promptly fell, causing us both to fall. And then us having just a like pathetic mech fight in the dirt. I had to then go to play a game of Scythe with some folks. So I handed over Jimmy the Claw Clamps. And they eventually died to the reactor of their mech completely going out and taking something like 39 points of heat in a single turn. So he dead, but his cousin, James Van Clamps of the Manhattan Van Clamps, has vowed vengeance in his King Crab at some point in the future. And it was just a hilarious game. And critically, I think for a multiplayer game and a learning game, you can't take a scenario based on a cooking pun terribly seriously.
Oh, no.
And so, like, it was just like, yeah, well, let's just have infinite light mechs and let's see how many we can kill. That sounds dope. What was nice for me is, like, all the weapons are the same range. So, like, the mental load of piloting a crab is just not that high. And so, yeah, that was a fun game. I haven't managed to play very many historicals recently. That makes me sad. I have been playing a lot of Silver Bayonet, though.
It's historical.
Which is a historical-esque. I played two games of one of the scenarios in Silver Bayonet Canada, because we happened to roll the same scenario twice. That was fun because I got to play both the attacker and defender and sort of confirm my suspicions about how that scenario works. One of the things I really like about Silver Bayonet is very commonly in scenarios, there's not a winner. The scenario we had, you start, one team starts in the middle and is surrounded, but is in range of almost all the clue markers at the very first start of the game. So if they extend themselves and commit to not shooting, they can investigate like four of the six clue markers, get a ton of experience, and then their job is to run off the board. And the other side generates a bunch of XP by killing dudes as they run away. There's not really a like, oh yeah, you won and I lost. There's like, you accomplished these couple objectives and got four experience points. I have accomplished these and got three. Okay, you came out better than me, but not really. And then I have been working my way through the solo campaign for Silver Bayonet, because the solo campaign for Silver Bayonet Canada expressly says you want an experienced squad. It does not state what that means. So my argument for it is, well, surely a couple regular games plus the solo game of the main book should count as a relatively experienced squad. And then I'll find out how wrong I am as polar bears eat my dudes.
Yeah, it'll be fine.
Yeah, or we'll be fine. Yeah, it'll be one of those two things. I will either die in the first mission and be like, oopsie poopsie, or it'll be fine. So I've been playing a fair amount of Silver Bayonet because primarily, especially the solo stuff, can be played at 3 o'clock in the morning by myself.
Well, now that we've kind of gotten all that out of the way, you know, 25 minutes of us talking about this, we need to record more, just in general.
Yes, we do need to record more. And lest we pull an independent characters and have 3-hour episodes, let's get into the main topic, a.k.a. Calvin's North Africa Info Dump Hour. One disclaimer for all of this, we're going to be talking about the North African campaign in World War II. This is not everything that happened in Africa. Battles were fought in East Africa. There was a battle fought to both take and then retake Madagascar. But generally speaking, when you say the North African campaign, what gets conjured is the sort of Egypt to Algeria, Northern Africa, sort of that band. And that's what we're going to talk about today.
So, in the vein of our, you know, what you need to know about this, much like our 30 Years War episode, we're starting with a condensed timeline of this, which I'm condensing like 3 years into a page of bullet points. So this is not extensive. This is what you need to know. So World War II happens. War were declared. Italy invades Egypt because Italy was trying to do the whole Roman Empire thing. They capture the town of Sidi Barani. Eventually, they get forced back, and most of the Italian army gets destroyed during Operation Compass, and the British capture the port of Tobruk. This will help us later. Right after that, Italians ask for reinforcements, and so Germany sends the Deutsche Afrika Korps, DAK, Afrika Korps, the guys in tan, the bad guys from, you know, the first Indiana Jones movie. Those guys. And at the same time, a lot of the experienced Allied forces that were in North Africa were pulled back to other areas to reinforce them. After that, the Axis forces push towards Tobruk because they need a port to supply things. Because this is a war where really heavily North Africa is about logistics. Like, I'm going to go tap the sign. It's boring, but it's hard to do war when your stuff doesn't work. So they need a port. Tobruk's there. It's fortified. They have maps of some of the fortifications because it was Italian. So they push towards Tobruk, but they can't capture it because the Australians in there do some heroic bullshit. The joke is that's the only way they could get beer is through the port. So they had to defend it. They can't capture the city. The Allies tried to free it multiple times. Eventually, this worked with Operation Crusader, which introduces a whole new type of tank, the Crusader. And they push them back to El Agheila, and things stabilize for a bit. Then comes the part where things get bad. The Axis start a new offensive. They smash through the Gazala line. They take Tobruk, and they have to fall back to El Alamein. And that leads to the first battle of El Alamein, where Rommel shows up and then gets punched in the face repeatedly. Some famous actions include the Battle of Ruisat Ridge. There's a lot of really fantastic visualizations of the first Battle of El Alamein. I recommend the one by a channel called The Operations Room. It's a really clear way to see what happened during the first Battle of El Alamein. However, at the end of this, there's an Allied command shakeup because they're not happy with the performance of the commander of the group, General Claude Auchinleck, and he's replaced with Alexander. And then for the Eighth Army itself, a guy named Bernard Montgomery becomes the commander of it. We will come back to him later. There's another assault on the El Alamein line at a place called Alam Halfa, but it's pushed back. Second battle of El Alamein happens, and Operation Lightfoot, they start pushing them back towards like Tobruk, and they start pushing them back, and it's a huge retreat. They're running because they have no supplies. They're outgunned. They're just running.
They being the Axis.
Yeah. They got kicked in the dick, and then they start running. And then, while all this is happening over in Egypt, in Morocco and Algeria, Operation Torch happens, and the U.S. shows up and goes, hello, they land on Gerimarco, and then they just kind of run straight through the Vichy French until the French surrender, and this leads to the Axis occupation of Vichy France, Case Anton.
This begins a trend of Axis country surrenders, and then Germany takes over their stuff. that we will see again in Italy, that is essentially as German allies start to waver, the German answer to this is, yeah, you're fired, and we'll take over now.
And then while they're in France, there are some political assassinations that happen and a lot of politics stuff happens. They eventually figure it all out and they get the support of the Free French. And then they push on towards Tunisia. And this is where America learns that war is a thing and gets punched in the face repeatedly at Kasserine Pass.
Yeah, the Kasserine Pass is definitely sort of America's fuck around and find out in terms of several of the countries that have been fighting this have developed tank warfare doctrine, and we haven't yet. And so after Kasserine, where we get rightly pummeled, there's a lot of revisiting of some assumptions we made.
It's kind of a, rebuild this, try this again. And then during this also, Rommel has been dealing with kind of illness throughout the entire time in North Africa because it's the desert. The desert hates you. He eventually is so sick he has to get pulled out. Both armies press up into Tunisia from the south and the east. And then eventually most of the forces still left in Tunisia are captured on May 13th, 1943. So 3 years of combat in a really, really awful place to be. Why did they do this? Well, the Axis, they wanted to cut a very important thing called the Suez Canal, which was essentially the lifeline for the British Empire, because it connected them way easier to all their colonies. And also, if they get through Egypt, they get to push right into the Middle East and fuel, you know, logistics.
Again, an awful lot of questions for why did the Germans do something? And with the answer, there was oil there. One of the critical things is Germany is not known for its abundant oil fields, and a largely mechanized mode of warfare needs oil, and planes need lubricant and all kinds of things. And so, and then we break into the Middle East was a very, very big part of this. And then, yeah, as Calvin mentioned, the Suez Canal is how you get from London to Gibraltar to Egypt to India to Singapore to Australia. Going around the long way is the long way. The Suez Canal is important. Obviously, the Allies don't want this to happen.
Yeah.
If your opponent is looking to cut off a major supply route and get a bunch of oil, one of your objectives is to have that not happen. Additionally, and this was a big sort of political consideration, this will also come up later in terms of what happens in the invasion of Sicily and Italy, there is a whole nother front being fought right now, the Eastern Front, and Stalin is very keen to have some pressure taken off the Russians. Right now, this is also the period of time when things are going okay for the Germans in Russia. And so, hey, can you all, instead of sitting in Britain shooting down ME-109s, get into the fight and start actually diverting troops, causing military casualties, pulling both German and Italian formations away from the Eastern Front? That is a major pressure point that the Russians are applying on Britain and the United States. And so this is a critical aspect of that, is literally this is opening up a second front to hopefully strain Germany.
And as another important piece of information in there, a little thing called the Battle of Stalingrad happened right in the middle of the time that they were doing lots of stuff in North Africa. So once again, getting resources away from that helped win that.
Yeah. And then finally, a really good way to invade Sicily and Italy is from Africa. It's both hard to not, it's hard to invade Sicily and Italy if you don't control North Africa. And then we have bases, we control both sides of the Mediterranean Sea, all the nice things that you want if you're talking about invading the homeland of one of the Axis powers.
So in other words, this mattered a lot because logistics. Now, as we're war gamers and we love characters, let's talk about the people that were going to be the big figures for this. And we're starting with one that I know I'm going to make some people angry about, and good. We are starting with Erwin Rommel. Short version, he served in World War I in the Italian front, became a teacher after the war, wrote a book about infantry tactics that's pretty good. He spearheaded a lot of the Battle of France at the head of the armor divisions. he got sent to North Africa and did everything we just talked about. Then he got sick, went back to Europe, eventually ended up being part of the command staff for the defense of Normandy. Valkyrie plot happened, which he was tangentially related to, and he was killed afterwards. However, was he a Nazi? Yes. Dude may not have been part of the party, but dude was enamored with Hitler. I hate the reputation laundering of, oh no, he was just a, like, no, dude. Dude was a Nazi.
Yeah. Rommel and the African Corps and the Wehrmacht generally are sort of the center of a degree of Nazi apologia. That is essentially like, this is the origins of the clean Wehrmacht myth. That like, Rommel and commanders like him were only following their orders and were noble soldiers, etc., etc. This sort of violates the, if you have a Nazi and four other people at a table, you have five Nazis rule. If you are a field marshal in Adolf Hitler's army, you're a Nazi. You might not be the worst of them, but that is akin to saying being shot in the leg is better than being shot in the chest. Strictly speaking, probably yes. Still not good.
Yeah. And the other thing about Valkyrie is it wasn't an anti-Nazi plot. They wanted to, like, you know, cut, or they wanted to make sure they could, you know, negotiate with the Western allies to stop the Soviets. It was an anti-Hitler plot, not an anti-Nazi plot. They wanted to keep the stuff they'd annexed. Like,
yeah, this was, can we press pause on the decline of the Third Reich? Not, we're sorry, we would really like to go back to being a perfectly legitimate republic. Oops. Can we talk about this a little bit? So next up on this list is Bernard Montgomery, a.k.a. Monty. He found himself in command after the first choice for command, a guy named William Gott, was killed in an aircraft accident. He was, and this is understandable for a British army that had lost a considerable number of men and a staggering amount of materiel in the Battle of France, to push towards casualty minimization. That this is, Britain is not currently capable of feeding men into the meat grinder as a method of warfare. So he has somewhat slow, somewhat cautious plans. He's also something of an egomaniac, and ends up clashing a lot with other commanders, both British and then later, importantly, American.
Famously, with one George Patton.
Yeah.
Another egomaniac.
Yeah, Monty and Patton did not get along, because one of them is an egomaniac who likes slow, cautious plans. The other one is an egomaniac who loves, fuck it, we ball. And both of them were essentially competing for, again, because everything is logistics, the same resources to try to advance the front in France. Montgomery is very successful in his role for this in North Africa, which elevates his career fairly seriously. He ends up being Field Marshal Montgomery, and he is later the mastermind for Operation Market Garden, which is, if you look up fiasco in the dictionary, something that says see also. And curiously, this man could not let go of the idea that maybe we just drop in a bunch of paratroopers, capture everything, and then some armored formations will come barreling through hell for leather and relieve them in time. Market Garden was the first of these. There was like three. This shows up a little bit in Operation Varsity, which takes place later and isn't a fiasco. This was Montgomery's plan for capturing Berlin, was we're going to drop a bunch of airborne divisions in a bunch of airfields in Berlin, and then IDK, some armored divisions, will get there in time. We end up abandoning that one because of both politics and both Eisenhower and the other...
Bradley
is like, yeah, Omar Bradley is like, I don't know about that, boss. And that's probably a good thing, because I love paratroopers. I have several paratrooper armies. Paratroopers will sort this out is a dubious doctrine at the best of times. He's just sort of an asshole. He at least closed out and arguably won this particular campaign. But like, I would not want him at a dinner party I was hosting.
Yeah. And to kind of tip our hand towards another person we're going to talk about later, after the war, things get weird.
That's a sort of through line I have found in what did the heroes of World War II in the British Army get up to after the war is often a fascinating rabbit hole of like either, oh no, or just like spiraling eccentricities.
Monty is the first. dude kind of goes down the like highly conservative rabbit hole and like not good.
Meanwhile, on the American side.
On the American side, we're going to talk about a guy named Dwight D. Eisenhower, a remarkably good staff officer who was originally put in charge of Operation Torch as kind of a, hey, we want the Americans involved in this. We're going to put an American in charge. He was really good at wrangling cats and egos when it came to work dealing with large numbers of staff. Later on, became the Allied overall commander for Europe in general. You know, was led for Normandy, led for the push through Germany, and dealt with several crises. And then also later, he became like president of the United States or something.
Low key, I like Ike.
Yeah, like honestly, dude was a fantastic example of an administrator being an administrator and good at what he did, because he never led troops in the field. He never led an army. He led an allied force really well, helped balance logistics, ego, including at one point when Monty was like ranting on about something and like being an egomaniac. Ike very carefully put his hand on his knee and said, "Monty, I'm your boss," and shut up Monty immediately.
So I have three stories about Eisenhower that are not in our notes because these have all occurred to me as we were talking about him. The first is that Dwight Eisenhower is also the man who cautioned us against the military-industrial complex. We should have fucking listened to Ike, as it turns out. So there's that. The second is a personal anecdote about my beloved younger brother, who I shared a room with when we were children, who at one point in the middle of the night woke me up and said, "There's a little man in the closet." And I was like, "Okay, childhood imagination, what are you talking about? And that's not okay." And he was like, "Yeah, there's a little man in the..." I turned on the lights and I had a Hex Encounter war game of D-Day that on the side cover is Ike Eisenhower's portrait. And that was the little man in the closet. And so I just loved the idea of a very tiny Dwight Eisenhower haunting my little brother. And the third, and this is largely apocryphal, but I get to do that because it's my show. I went to Tufts University for undergrad. It's a liberal arts college in either Somerville or Medford, Massachusetts, depending on which side of campus you're on. And that college won the Second World War. And the reason for that is because Dwight Eisenhower, when he was in college, played football there and broke his leg, which derailed his promising collegiate football career and caused him to concentrate on his studies. This is clearly fully causal with Dwight Eisenhower becoming Supreme Allied Commander for Europe and winning the Second World War. So thank your local jumbo for breaking Eisenhower's legs in the 30s.
But short version, no. Ike is a fantastic commander and a, honestly, like, if you want to talk about a good general,
yeah,
Eisenhower. Now we get interesting.
David Sterling, founder of the SAS. Calvin, the SAS and the Long Range Desert Group are your babies. You want to take us through David Sterling's career?
Absolutely. So David Sterling was an officer in the British Army who had an idea. Essentially, it's like, hey, what if we run out into the desert to just fuck around? You know, it's just like, hey, well, let's run out there. Let's do this, like, behind enemy lines. We got, finally, what we need to do, like, deep penetration missions of, like, reliable light vehicles, radios, things like that. So we're going to fuck around back there. Essentially, at that point, it was nothing else has worked. Go nuts. So they did. And they ran out. The first one was in support of Operation Crusader. That one did not go as well because they tried to parachute in and didn't work quite as well. Later on, it ended up working better. They would steal jeeps and cover them in machine guns. Stolen is a strong word. They got their hands on things. And if you'll notice, this kind of small teams messing around behind enemy lines, this is where special forces come from. This is where that whole idea comes from. Later on, after several of these airfield raids, he's captured by the Germans. He gets released after the war. And then, just to kind of give you an idea, on his quick Wikipedia page, just for an idea, there's post-war activities in Africa, which short version is he tried to do colonial administration, mercenary and arms dealer, tried to organize a private army to overthrow the government, or to protect the government from a private army that would overthrow the government, called Great Britain 75, and then undermining trades unionism. As we said,
that's an eclectic mix.
Things get weird. Even another famous British dickhead, Bernard Montgomery, described him as mad, quite mad. I mean, just to do a slight aside, though, the cooler member of the SAS was Paddy Maine. He's interesting in a different way in the fact that he was an Irish rugby player who, while in Africa in 1938, like as part of the rugby team, he smashed up colleagues' hotel rooms, freed a convict he had befriended, and left from a formal dinner to go antelope hunting. Also would like box, became a lawyer after the war. Paddy Maine is another wild dude.
Yeah, the guys who thought driving around jeeps in the desert, blowing up German airfields, seemed like a swell idea, all had a dose of eccentric adventurism in them that after the war and the sort of death throes of the British Empire manifest in a number of different ways. And lest we neglect the Italians, who did fight the bulk of the North Africa campaign and did so quite effectively at times, we have Ugo Cavallero. He is a dedicated Mediterranean warfare expert. He fought in 1913 during the Italo-Turkish War in Libya. In the First World War, was a brigadier general. And during the Second World War, ends up becoming a very prominent commander in the Italian army and was involved in the invasion of Greece, etc., and is eventually put in command of most of the forces in North Africa. He, too, is, despite the occasional claims, including by him to the contrary, a dedicated fascist who worked very well with Albert Kesselring, who was the commander before Rommel, and got on not great with Rommel. He wanted to invade Malta rather than headed into Egypt. Malta remained a thorn in the Axis side for the entire war, a desperate little island defense that is so cool and very much not the focus of really anything, which is sad.
The second most interesting siege of Malta.
Yes, the second most interesting siege of Malta. He is promoted to Marshal of Italy on the 1st of July, 1942, primarily to keep Field Marshal Rommel from outranking him. And he generally is in command as things start to go poorly. In 1943, after the sort of definitive failure of the African campaign and the collapse of the Italian army in Russia, he is dismissed. And then when Mussolini's government is toppled, he is arrested. He writes a letter that says he had opposed Mussolini and his regime. Please let me out of jail. Some diplomacy happens. He is then released by the Germans in September of 1943 as what is the fate of the Italian government sort of changes. Because importantly, the government of Mussolini is overthrown well before Italy is actually liberated, which we'll talk about at some point. We will do a Eric's info dump hour about the Italian campaign. So there's a very interesting conundrum of what happens when half your country is still occupied by the Germans when you surrender. So antics ensue. He is released. And Kesselring offers him command of the Italian Social Republic, which is the Italian puppet state reformed by the Germans. But the letter where he's like, no, no, I hated Mussolini, makes some people somewhat suspicious of his motives. And then mysteriously, he's found dead by gunshot in his hotel, having talked to Kesselring the night before. Who knows why? Who knows who shot him?
Huh.
Very mysterious.
Something, something Boeing whistleblowers?
Yes, yes. It's a little bit questionable how he died. So that is our cast of characters. We have some good guys. We have some eccentric guys on the side of the good guys. We have some bad guys of varying degrees of badness.
And this is not even counting some of the other colorful characters you could go with. Like, for example, we didn't go into very much detail on Patton, who is very much a character.
Yeah, because Patton will show up later and he'll get plenty of coverage. But yeah, so this is sort of a fun cast of characters. It's a lot of people who don't get a lot of attention in sort of how we think about the war, with the exception of Rommel, Monty, and Eisenhower. There are other people doing cool things here. So then that brings us to sort of the next section when we do these sort of period pieces, which is, why is this fun to game? Calvin, because this is absolutely your baby, why is this fun to game?
Well, to start with, it's always a back and forth. Like, I know I only kind of breezed over like it being back and forth, but no, they were swinging back and forth across the desert constantly. It's what happens when, like, the idea is they push from one port towards the enemy, and then they stretch out their supply lines, they get slowed down, and then so the other side's able to push them back because they're closer to their port and supply lines, and push them back towards theirs. So because of logistics, it goes back and forth constantly. It also helps that they're stuck in like a 40-mile band, essentially, at the top of Africa, because what runs right below them is a little thing called the Sahara Desert.
Yeah, and no one's going to run tanks through that. This is actually, I think, a frequent feature of wars in North Africa generally. If you look at the Crusades, if you look at Napoleon's campaigns in Egypt, if you look at the First World War and the campaigns in North Africa, there's a lot of, we're stuck near the coast, we're dependent on supplies from ships. This becomes the major governing factor. Can your march from your port push your enemy out of their port, so it's your port now? If no, things are not good. And so I think that that does really help this. One thing that does come up that is of interest to both of us is this is a tank war. You have lots of armored vehicles, and it is prior to the big cats. So it is prior to the Panthers and Tigers. Like, the Tigers show up at the very end of this, but not in either numbers or time to change things.
Like, I think it's maximum. I think they had like 30 Tiger ones in Tunisia or something. Yeah.
This is the first time the Allies get to capture a Tiger and study it. But
Tiger 131. It's actually a really interesting story.
Yeah. So you get before the sort of big cats, and also importantly, before the solution to not having terribly good tanks is to have lots of pretty good tanks. And the sort of, if a Panther has a 4-to-1 kill ratio against Shermans and I send 5 Shermans, bad news. And so you don't have either one of those things. You have, the British have, cruisers, Matildas, things like that. The Germans are fighting with the iconic tanks of sort of the Middle War. The Panzer III is the sort of workhorse of the North African campaign. You have the Panzer IV. You have Italian armor actually doing things. Like, the Italians had tanks, and they weren't bad tanks.
There's actually a really interesting quote, I believe it's from a British officer, who, well, this is going to be a little bit of a slight rant about the portrayal of Italians in games of World War II. They weren't cowards. They were not motivated. Because if you're a conscript who doesn't really believe in the whole, like, you know, make the new Roman Empire thing, and you're out there, and you start getting shot at, it's called, like, yeah, no, I don't want to deal with this. I'm not dealing with this. But there were some forces, such as the Bersaglieri, the Alpini, and specifically the tankers, specifically of the Ariete division, which I believe the British described them as the bravest men sent to die in broken down toys, because the tanks were fairly outdated. But another great quote is from the First Battle of El Alamein, where the Ariete division is shredded. They can't get contact for several days. And when they finally do, when the Germans contact them, they say, we are down to 3 tanks. We're counterattacking. So,
which is just balling.
Short rant.
Yeah, I think both of us will. Eventually, we're going to cover the Italian campaign. And I'm going to mention, the Italians are not a thing. Also, you get some really fun things with this on the American side, because this is our entry into mechanized warfare. we have the M3 Lee / Grant, depending on which country you're fighting it with, which is a tank destroyer with a turret on top.
It's weird and I love it.
It's weird and I love it too. And it's ridiculous. But it's sort of popular because it can fire HE rounds. And as it turns out, what tanks mostly do is fire HE rounds at infantry. And the British didn't have that. And so the British were like, this is sort of garbage, but also sort of handy. You have the M3 or M5 Stuart, which is my beloved and precious short-lived light tank. It is sort of my... I love it. I don't know why. But again...
I have two.
Yeah, I've got a bunch of unassembled ones. They're fun. Again, badly needed by the British. The British eventually discover in theirs that it is faster to turn the tank than it is to turn the turret. There's some great stuff about that, but you get before the answer for American tank doctrine is tank destroyers and Shermans. Build more of those. You get some experimentation, some things figuring out. So there's a lot of fun with that. And I think additionally, one of the things that comes up with this in when you read scenarios and things like that is this is in, it's not in the Sahara, but it is in the desert. Tanks need water. Tanks need fuel. Tanks kick up dust. So you can have an armored advance that ends up having no idea where it is. And actually, Goonhammer has a really good, I think it's 8-part series of a German attack into a South African infantry division where the support units get ahead of the main advance for the South Africans. The Germans thrust forward and end up getting themselves surrounded, but then just sort of shoot their way out because they're in the middle of the support units. You get things like that where you have sort of a literal fog of warfare brought to you by North African dust.
So armored combat is cool. Armored combat in the desert, even cooler, because there's more things to play with. Another fun thing is the other half of the war that you get to play with is special forces are a thing. They start becoming a thing where the SAS shows up, the LRDG shows up, my true beloved. The Italians look at this and go, we can do that too. And they create the Auto Sahariana, who get in a series of like running gun battles with the LRDG, which is awesome. And I don't know how it took until 2 years ago for the SAS and LRDG to get a piece of media made about them. Rogue Heroes, it's not entirely accurate, but it's fun.
But it's fun.
And it's just a really interesting way, and it gives you lots of really interesting asymmetrical scenarios.
And I think here is also a good, this comes up in the 0200-hour stuff, but you could also do it in a game like Chain of Command or Bolt Action. This is also a really good excuse to field rear echelon troops, where it's like, no, I was supposed to be minding this perfectly safe airfield. Why am I being shot at? And so you can do, you know, a lot of focus for all armies for understandable reasons is like the good frontline units. And then when you get the sort of backline units for especially the Germans, this tends to be because they're running out of frontline units and it's 1945. But this is a good excuse to field those types of units where like, yeah, I have sort of a grain or understrength infantry with a bunch of AA guns defending a airfield, and then suddenly some British mad lads come careening over a sand dune, and we've got a fight. So there's, I think, a lot of room for that as well as the sort of counterpoint to those special forces, as you get sort of that elite versus non-elite sort of army if you want to.
And an excuse to do lots of really interesting pieces of terrain, which I have a list for.
Yeah, we've got wrecked tanks. I've got a Stuka that's being planned for because, like, if you're going to raid an airfield, you should have an airplane. And yeah, a Stuka is actually multiple Stukas. there's lots of things like that. You sandbag emplacements for AA guns, water tanks. There's all kinds of things that I think are really cool. Palm trees.
Trucks. Like, yeah. Oh, another fun thing that we didn't quite talk about here, which we can kind of talk about a little bit when we get to the hobby side of it, which a big part there is, this is a quick to paint theater. It's tan.
Everything's tan.
Occasionally you get some interesting camouflage patterns. the big famous one near the start of the war is the contour pattern camouflage, which I've done at 15 mil. I didn't want to do it at 28 mil.
This is for painting real easy, especially if you have an airbrush. Vallejo, AK Interactive, Ammo of Meg, all of those people sell British desert camouflage and Africa Corps camouflage. You stick it in an airbrush and you're done. Like, now you have to paint the treads. It's also a really good excuse to do weathering that's not mud. If you want to do sand and grits and leaking oil and things like that, this is a really good excuse to play with those.
Another hobby thing that's fun to point out is there was lots of using captured equipment on both sides. There's pictures of Italian tanks with kangaroos painted on the side being crewed by Australians. There's crusaders with iron crosses on the sides of their turrets because you're in the desert. You're going to use anything that has a gun and wheels, or a gun and tracks, or any sort of truck. Like, if it works, you're going to use it. So go nuts with your modeling.
And the last thing we have is sort of why this is fun to game is, if you are interested in the British contribution to the war, this is Britain's center stage theater. It is, until Torch and then the subsequent collapse of the entire North African campaign, this is the British, the Australians, the New Zealanders, the Sikhs, the Commonwealth holding off Germany and Italy. But so early in the war, you have the French and the British. And while that's I think a really cool period that people don't play enough, the fall of France is a little bit of a blink and you miss it campaign. This is Britain fighting this out for 3 years. So if you're interested in sort of Britain as the center stage power, of course, this is not to minimize the British contributions to the rest of the war. But in that case, it is always Britain, the United States, Canada, everybody else who's along for the ride. In my alternate timeline, Ireland, it's always the Allies are doing things. This is, until Operation Torch, the British are doing things. And so if you're interested in that, if you're interested in playing with those Commonwealth armies, you know, what are the South Africans up to? The Australians.
The Indian Brigade.
The Indians. Like, there's all kinds of really cool stuff that comes on here. Speaking of all the armies you could possibly play for this, what armies do we have? This will again be Calvin talks a lot and Eric talks a little.
So this is my hyperfixation. This is my thing. I have the biggest one I have is I have the 8th Army for roughly El Alamein. Like, everything's kind of loose because equipment got used everywhere. So roughly I have that, which is like an infantry platoon and enough supports to kind of do whatever the hell I want. I also have the Africa Corps around the same period. And similarly, I'm building it up to just kind of have enough support to do whatever I want. I have a U.S. Army platoon for Kasserine Pass. That one is, I'm not going to go expand them quite as much. Like, I'm going to, like, get my platoon and then kind of be done.
And then have that be, if you want a learning game where someone wants to play the Americans.
Yeah.
Grats. Here's your Americans.
We're in Tunisia. Let's go. I have my one true baby, which is my long-range desert group patrol of some trucks, some jeeps, some SAS guys along for the ride. And now my most recent one has been kind of my Italian platoon with extras. The Italians are there so I can play an army that's not Germany.
Yeah. If you want a break from playing your Africa Corps guys.
Yeah. Which, honestly, they're probably the army I've played the most, because also there's times when it's like, I don't quite have the right army to do this, so we're just some Africa Corps painted guys that are in, like, Sicily or something. Or, like, a weird one I did was a teaching game where it was membership officer for our club.
Eloy.
He wanted to play the Marines, so I gave him the Marines, and I played Africa Corps, and we slugged it out. It was fun.
Fair enough. Alternate history where the Marines go the other direction.
Yeah.
A single troop ship gets real lost.
Yeah.
So on my end, I don't have anything. This is not conventionally a theater I've been particularly interested in. Calvin's enthusiasm has changed that a bit, but as we've discussed, I paint slow. And so this is low on the list because Italy is my obscure front of choice. And so we will come to that eventually. I do have the Africa Core Dudes and the SAS for 0200 hours because I bought that set because it seemed neat. When we're talking about the alternate history Irish, it is entirely possible that this could be the first deployment of the Irish, either as commandos attached to the Brits or as part of Torch, that essentially, you know, a division of Irish tagged along for the fun. Where again, I get to field crappy tanks, because one of the sort of narrative things for the Irish is they're not getting the early prototypes of the good stuff. So them rocking around in Lees and Stuarts and the 10 home produced tanks they're going to produce based on a Swedish design is entirely credible as like, yeah, no, they're also just figuring this out. So that's possibly doable. This is one where if Calvin held a gun to my head and said, your project this year is to do a North African army. As I've sort of mentioned, I could be persuaded to do the Americans at some point here because I really like the stopgap tanks and the really untested doctrinal aspects of this, that like the U.S. Army is still figuring itself out. This is an excuse to field like entirely green troops who don't really know what's going on. And their tanks are just okay, but already sort of obsolete, even though they just got here, and sort of have that before America really locks in the pattern of tanks, infantry and mechanization, artillery, air support, just the whole combined arms package, where we're still figuring all that out, is definitely something I could play in that. And I could see, you know, some other sort of obscure troops there where like, yeah, I could do a platoon of Vichy French or something like that. I could see that. But yeah, generally speaking, the only thing I have that if you were like, we need to do this tomorrow, what have you got? The answer is the Africa Corps and attendant Brits for the 0200 hours desert set.
I was going to say also for Italy, I do have plans to build an Alpini army. So like,
sweet.
You'll get some Italians to play with.
I will send my Irish up against the Alpini. That will go poorly for everyone. So if you want to play this theater, what games should you play? The answer is there's a lot.
There's World War II games.
World War II is probably the most heavily war-gamed war out there. Maybe second to Napoleonic's, but I'm not sure. Bolt, like, if you exclude bolt action, I think that becomes harder. But like bolt action is the non-GW, you know, juggernaut of miniature wargaming. So the first answer is bolt action. It's there. If you're talking about historicals, and you sort of have the same justification I have for why I play 40K, which is if someone is playing, that's what they're playing, you should probably have a bolt action army because it's played everywhere.
There is actually another thing I'll point out, which is for World War II games, we are going to not talk about that game. We're not talking about the campaign for North Africa. We're not talking about that massive box of nightmare.
That precious, beautiful monument to mankind's hubris. But if you want to look that up, look up Campaign for North Africa and gaze into the Well of Madness. An alternative for bolt action that is largely on the same scale is Chain of Command by Two Fat Lardies. This game has like one game of the year. It's really good. It's really interesting. One of the things I like about it, especially for this scenario, is it does the fog of war aspect really quite well, in that the start of any Chain of Command game is you sort of fumbling about looking for things. And especially in this setting where there's a lot of trucks and things like that, one of the disadvantages of bolt action is sort of famously there's an Italian anti-tank, self-propelled anti-tank gun that is just a big-ass anti-tank gun on the back of a flatbed truck. In bolt action, you look at that and go, well, that obviously has to die right now. And if you go first, it'll probably be dead before it gets to shoot. In Chain of Command, you won't know it's there until it gets deployed and shoots you at least once, which is much more how this was supposed to go. So there are some aspects of that that are interesting. I have been trying to push Chain of Command to the local club. It's not catching very well, but that's a project it's a long-term project of mine. I do have some people interested in it.
Yeah, including me.
Yeah. Like, worst case, I've got Calvin interested in it. And the armies are very similar. I was talking to someone interested in building an Italian army, and the difference between the bolt action starter set and what you need for a platoon in Chain of Command is like, okay, buy two of those dudes, and you're done. Because it is, again, another platoon-level combat game.
And I know we're both on different sides of this split. I personally prefer bolt action more because I think the activation system is really smooth and like it works exactly as I need it to.
Yeah, it's well understood. And like it's designed by people who are really good at designing war games. So like it's popular for a reason.
And then we've been talking about mainly 28 millimeter because that's mainly what we wargame. However, there are smaller scale options, such as Flames of War by Battlefront Games. Except for the fact, I really don't like the rules for Flames of War. That's a personal thing for me. It just does not jive with me at all. There's some interesting bits of it, but it's not for me.
Yeah, I was interested in Flames of War, but it never really grabbed me. So it's one we don't push. I do want to note that Chain of Command is technically scale agnostic. Everyone plays it at 28 millimeter, but if you like sit down and actually figure out the ranges, it's more like a 15 to 20 millimeter game. It's just everybody likes the pretty big tanks. So you can play Chain of Command by buying a bunch of stuff for Flames of War, or actually very little stuff for Flames of War, and then being done. Along those same lines,
we have a game called Iron Cross, which is made by the same people who made one of our other favorite games, and uses a very similar system called 7 Days to the River Rhine, which is our preferred World War III game. And so we looked at Iron Cross, and we went, we should check that out soon. So
yeah,
if you want to do 15 mil.
And that makes it even easier to paint, because then that really is just like, what is the base color? What is the second color? Paint the tracks, call it a day. So there's that. If you are interested in larger scale, but largely sort of tank battles, there's What a Tanker, which is the actually original game in the What a X series, which is a great sort of light. It's been described as sort of arcadey. So if you want like World of Tanks, but on a battlefield, What a Tanker is there. That does well. Interestingly, Warlord's new somewhat more gritty tank game, Achtung Panzer, does not appear to have pre-Europe feeder rules. They may have expansions that do that.
Just right now, it's a watch the skies. It may show up.
We've got 0200 Hours, which is a great small units action game that's got a lot of different, like, there's one that's essentially downed pilots in Norway. There's one that's the French Resistance. There's a lot of classic getting up to no good in the French countryside shenanigans. And one of the more recent sets is Raids in the Desert. This includes a model that is definitely not Rommel. Why are you asking that question? And is just a really great game. And nicely has, if not a solitaire mode, a solitaire friendly approach. And it's just a lot of fun.
It does have a solitaire mode. They did a free PDF add-on to the rules that's, hey, you can now run the sentries off this guide. Essentially, here's an AI for them.
Nice.
Go nuts.
And yeah, it's a lot of fun. Calvin and I have played it once or twice. It's a good game. Importantly, we played it once or twice, and I bought all of it.
Yeah.
Which is usually a good sign. Including, I got the set I didn't buy. There's one set that's sort of Nazi super science, and I was like, I don't feel like going down that path. And then one of the other sets I bought got mispacked, and so I got that anyway. So I probably still won't use the Nazi super science guys, but now I have some Royal Marines Commando, which there's worse things to have. Then there are sort of, if you want to go to other scales and other aspects of this theater, we've mentioned supplies a lot, and we've used the word port. There is also a very intense naval campaign around control of the Mediterranean Sea, which is the Royal Navy versus the Regia Marina. So you got Italy versus the Royal Navy. Italy is actually a major naval contender in this particular period, and they are a real threat to the Royal Navy, and several times the Royal Navy gets a bloody nose fighting them. And there's a very intense battle to keep Malta supplied, to keep North Africa supplied, convoy escorts. Importantly here, there's a very interesting dynamic, which is unlike a lot of the convoy stuff that takes place in the North Atlantic, you are always in range of Italian and German bombers if you're in the Mediterranean. So there's a very intensive sort of air war component to the naval games. Victory at Sea, there's other ones, but Victory at Sea is the big one.
We could Cruel Seas for this as well.
Yeah, you could do Cruel Seas for this. Cruel Seas picks up a lot more when you have the actual, when you're in Sicily and Italy. It's entirely viable to do cruel seas here, especially things like submarines versus a convoy with its attendant escorts. For the air war, there's, I looked at Bloody Skies, and again, that appears to primarily focus on a somewhat later war. Very similar to the sort of ground war. The air war here, you have a lot of weird stuff that sort of is immediately obsolete everywhere else, but you've still got it and it still works in North Africa. So like short sterlings, which were important in very early sort of the war because they were the first British heavy bomber, are very rapidly somewhat obsolete. They all get sent to North Africa. There are Gloucester Gladiators, which are wildly obsolete fighters. This theater doesn't get, there's P-40s. This theater doesn't get the frontline good aircraft until sort of the Battle of Britain starts stabilizing a little bit. So you get, again, a lot of eclectic stuff. You get Italian fighter planes, some of which are beautiful and actually pretty good. I will give the Italians credit both for their ships and their planes. They're pretty. Whether or not they're good, they're pretty. The Italians, just perfect design language. So there's games like Bag the Hun, where you could viably play the air war for this area. There's some really cool campaign modes around Bag the Hun. Again, it's a two fat lardies game. So the answer for World War II is a lot of World War II games, but not all of them. Primarily because some of them pick up later in the war or very much want to focus on that sort of, okay, so we're in Europe period. So yeah, that's the games, but where do you get the models?
The very first one on there is Warlord Games. Do you want plastic troops? You can get the plastic troops you need, period. Americans, Germans, British, Commonwealth, Italians, whatever you need, they have it in plastic. They've got a huge range of various support weapons for all the armies for any time. They just redid their, like, for example, they just redid their 2-pounder anti-tank gun for the 8th Army. So if you want the very first guns, you can have them. You can get Long Range Desert Group. Most of mine are those. You can get the SAS. All of mine are those. If you need a thing, they probably have it. Period.
It may not be the best of it, but they have it and it's in plastic. Along those same lines, you have the Perry brothers, whose first plastic kits were the Africa Corps and the 8th Army / Desert Rats. They've got pretty good forces for that. Calvin, do you want to talk a little bit about Blitzkrieg Minis? Because I haven't actually looked at them very much.
So they partner with a company called Blitzkrieg Minis that does a lot of armor kits that are like resin 2-3 pieces. Like, for example, my Crusader is one of them. It's just like on their website in metal ranges in World War II. I also have one of their LRDG trucks in mine. It's anything you can't find at Warlord, you can find from Blitzkrieg. And it will be like four parts to put together. So,
yeah, along those same, along some of those same lines, Wargame3D.net is a manufacturer of obviously 3D printing files for this. They've got a pretty wide selection of tanks, especially for things like there are French fighting vehicles, there's destroyed vehicles, there's the Italians they're currently doing a Kickstarter for, there's the German, there's the British. So you have a lot of those things. I have found they print fairly well. I have an issue with hollow models, but that's not their problem. And the last one is one that we always mention because we're both a little bit in love with them, which is Empress Miniatures. They don't actually have a lot for this theater, but what they do have is stuff for slightly earlier, for the Italians versus the Ethiopians. If you want to play that campaign and then potentially the very early battles that take place right after Italy declares war on Great Britain about the invasion of like British Somaliland and the various shenanigans that get up there, which ends much earlier, but again, has that nice like janky interwar tanks and armored cars and like somebody has four fighter planes and that's a very big deal. So you can do stuff. They are really good for any sort of interwar interest. So that we thought we'd drop a note. So given all of those options, there are a couple really good places to get started. The first one is, because we mentioned Warlord, there's the Gentleman's War box set, which will get you a German force and a British force. The caveat to this is there is a new edition of Bolt Action expected in September. And so, like, if you learn the Bolt Action rules by heart, you're going to have to deal with new edition transitions. But they have said that if you buy the starter boxes, essentially you got a coupon for the new rule book that will come out. Like, it's not currently a terrible idea in the same way that, like, I don't know that you want to buy a 40K box set before the edition comes out. So the Gentleman's War is a quick and easy starter set. It is often on sale. It's good.
Yeah, and you can use everything in it. Like, sometimes you get a starter box where you're like, oh, this is kind of weird. I'm not going to use everything in this, but no. Everything in the starter box, it's like each side gets 24, 28 infantry and an armored car. You are going to use everything in that. Like, since I got that, I've used the armored cars essentially every game I've brought them out. Like the Humber and the 222 are probably some of my favorite models I have for my armies. Like, they're pretty. I like them.
Yeah, they're great models.
However, this is 28 mil. What if we want something slightly smaller? You have two options, because the folks at Battlefront have given us two North Africa starter boxes. There's the Kasserine Pass, which is Americans and Germans, and there's Tobruk, which is British and Italians.
That covers everybody.
The one slight thing is these are all vehicles, with the exception of some artillery pieces for both Axis armies.
So if you want to play small scale, what a tanker, or something like Iron Cross or Flames of War, this is great. But it's definitely, Battlefront's heart is in armored warfare, which in this particular case is not the worst thing. So that's really good starter boxes. And the nice part about buying boxes for Flames of War, and this also applies for Team Yankee, is those are generally the most model dense games in the 15 millimeter range. So generally speaking, if you buy one of their starter boxes, you're set for a lot of other game system. Now, this, of course, won't necessarily apply for something like Chain of Command, if you want to do Chain of Command at a smaller scale. But for a lot of the tank games, this is all you're going to need for a real long time. And then finally, wrapping that up, we have the 0200 Hours game set by Gray For Now Games. They have a Desert Raid set that comes with the Germans you need, the Brits you need, some terrain by Sarissa Precision. Their sets are really good for, like, okay, I'm set now. So yeah, those are good places to get started. And then, of course, there's probably a Victory Seat starter set. But those are the three, like, when someone says, I want to play North Africa, that's where I'd start thinking.
Yeah. So what have we done for this? Together, I think, like, one game.
We have played one game of Bolt Action.
Yeah, which is where that the fun little bit at the start of the episode comes from, with a courageous artillery officer ending my career.
Yeah, that is the origins of the cold open sniper artillery observer that did just wreck Calvin's day in a single salvo. I have rarely seen something built on quite such randomness that deflated someone quite as fast as that.
It was bad.
It was bad. I need to mentally check myself and remember that that is not how all artillery strikes work. Because as far as I am currently concerned, having played that as 100% of the Bolt Action games I have ever played, British artillery is this unstoppable juggernaut that surely won the war for us single-handedly. That's not true. So I have to keep that in mind. But as you've mentioned, you've used this a lot for your learn Bolt Action armies.
Yeah, because I normally don't have to grab very much terrain for it, because you're in the desert. Like, there's not much there. The armies are... I literally have the two armies in the same box. So if someone says, hey, I want to learn, I can go, cool. Grab it, go. And it's pretty easy to understand, because it's like, cool. Infantry, artillery, tanks. Go. They're normally pretty evenly matched. I can kind of mess around a little bit with some fun things. Normally, I'm playing the Germans, as is my constant thing. Normally, I even have a mission put together that is... It's designed for the Germans to not win on purpose. So when I'm playing the Germans, the other player can feel good about it. which is just Escape and Encirclement.
Which is also sort of a common theme for a lot of learning armies, I think, is you shouldn't throw the game to have your opponent win. But the best way to get someone into a game is to have them feel good about the game. And a real easy way to make someone feel good about the game is to have them win. So I think both of us approach learning armies as ones requiring some degree of tactical nuance. The army I use to teach people Titanicus has a lot of melee built into it, which means for several turns, I'm not actually doing very much to you. When we talked about what a stormtrooper, we were picking sort of hard to play factions. So I've seen that. The other nice part about the stuff for our club is we have a very passionate Necromunda guy, Russell, who is also essentially our terrain project manager. And so the first of the terrain projects that got finished was the Wasteland terrain, so that someday we can play an Ash Wastes campaign. As it turns out, the Ash Wastes and North Africa are not that different. So if you want tannish rocks to hide behind, we have an abundance of that at our club. And so that's another nice part about using it. Calvin, you want to talk about your long-range desert group for a bit as a heartbreaking work of staggering genius?
So when I was in, probably was like start of high school, I got a book called Killing Rommel, which is a fictionalized account of an LRDG patrol. And I just fell in love immediately. So this was something I did later on in high school, which is I built a Lego LRDG truck. There are machine guns. I can't find them where they are right now, but I
built
one.
That's amazing. I love it.
And since I built this, originally I was going to do this as a Lego project, and then I grew out of Legos a little bit. Just a little bit. They're still behind me. But
you got that dog in you.
Yeah. And now, after 10 years, I finally have a long-range desert group patrol as an army. They're together. They're built. They're based. They're painted. I'm a little scared to put them on a table because I'm very attached to them.
At some point, if you want to, I will play your Germans and you can shoot at me with machine gun jeeps.
So yeah, the LRDG are like my passion project for wargaming, period. Like, while I may have a lot of work in a lot of my other armies, like the only other army I can think of that comes close to them is probably my Cities of Sigmar, as like the armies that I love so deeply.
That just speak to you.
Yeah.
So on the notion of things that speak to you and your forever armies, what are our future plans for this particular theater?
So you mentioned the forever armies, which is there's not an endpoint on my 8th Army and my Africa Corps. I'm always going to probably be adding something.
What will you do if I buy you a Tiger One?
I'll paint it tan.
For the listeners, I have now inflicted building several big cats on Calvin because I got the Achtung Panzer starter set, and Calvin notoriously doesn't like the big cats. And so continuing to harass him via buying him models.
Well, no, here's the thing. Well, first off, this is not the craziest model you've bought me. I still have a destroyer up there for Cruel Seas that's not built.
Fair enough.
But if I have to get a big cat, like in the future for the army, there is a plan to buy a Tiger One, because that is the one big cat I will accept owning.
Fair enough.
It was there.
It was there.
But yeah, like just there is not an endpoint. There is not I am done with the 8th Army or I'm done with the Africa Corps. Maybe it's like, oh, I'm going to paint a truck, or, oh, I want to paint a mortar team.
Or a different spin on this, like what, you know.
I've got a whole extra platoon lying next to me. Maybe I'll do an Indian platoon, you know? And the other idea I have is the airfield raid as a participation game, where ideally it's like, cool, we're doing an airfield raid. We build all the terrain. I've got the armies written out. Essentially, this is where the LRDG army originally came from, was this. And the idea is to take this to a convention with lots of beautiful terrain and lots of eye-catching. Because like the reason that I would want to put the effort in to make really good-looking Stuka models to put on the table is so they catch the attention and make people want to play it. Because it's a piece of history that sounds like it's out of a bad action movie.
And so this is a salute-esque. This is a showpiece that we have worked on and looks cool. And you know, yeah, we have three Stukas just sitting waiting on the landing strip as terrain for this. I, of course, as the local narrative campaign junkie and the person with the 3D printer, am extremely susceptible to this sort of notion. And so, yeah, I think this is something that we're going to work on. I've been interested in doing more sort of showpiece games where the answer is like, hey, yeah, no, show up on this particular Saturday, bring yourself, play bullshit as a notion.
And the LRDG works really well for having multiple people because it could be cool. They often had to split up their, yeah, you know, patrol. It's like, cool, you get two trucks, you get two trucks, you get the SAS portion of a transport truck and some Jeeps.
Yeah.
You all have to work together. Good luck. So if we go back to our previous episode on cool eras of history or like cool periods, North Africa doesn't have very much in the way of media to look at. But the one piece it does have that's really good is about the SAS. Rogue Heroes. It's fun. Go watch it.
Yeah, somehow I sort of simultaneously, like while we were prepping for this episode, once we had scheduled it, the algorithm decided to feed me clips from that. And that's always dangerous. So what's I think as we sort of close this down, because we're rounding on 2 hours, what's our one sentence pitch for, if you're interested, like sell me on North Africa?
Tanks or shenanigans? You get lots of both.
And I do love both tanks and shenanigans. That's a good pitch. So yeah, the conclusion for this is a fun place to start in World War II. It is a little bit like, and this is where we sort of balance the, they were all still Nazis with the clean Wehrmacht myth. This is the least horrible, which is not to say it was good, but it was the least horrible. It's a fun place to start. You get tanks, you get cool shit. You start with, you know, a lot of the weird tanks, a lot of stuff that you won't see later in the war. It's a fun place to start. Find sort of what part of this vibes for you. Is that the small action stuff? Is that tank battles? Is that sort of combined arms stuff? There's a lot of different sort of places to go. And really you get those really good sort of central, this is sort of a lot of the iconic pieces from the war come from here. This is where people start being afraid of the 88 anti-tank gun, is some desperate Africa Corps guys lower an anti-aircraft gun and shoot it at a tank, and everyone goes, oh shit. So like, it's a good place to start. And you get the weird tanks that disappear.
A9 cruisers.
A9 cruisers, things like that. You know, the Italian tanks, Lees and Grants, those just wacky tanks, you get those. So that's it for this show. Thank you all very much for hanging out with us. Now we need to thank our staff and do some plugs.
So first off, just thank you to our editor, Adrian, who's very good at making us not sound as incoherent as we think we are.
Definitely, definitely value Adrian. Thank you very much.
We appreciate adorably, you.
Adrian messaged me, I think last night, being like, I haven't heard from you guys in a while. Is everything okay? And then very kindly offered themselves as a tribute to, if you want to have a episode of one of us talks to a largely ignorant participant about something aspect of this, which is very kind of them. But yes, thank you, Adrian, for editing our words to sound like
better words.
Also, a thank you to our artist, Space Art Punk, on Twitter and Twitch, for our lovely little chibis you see at the top of our episode art and our wonderful logo that we'll eventually do something with.
Yep. If you're watching this on YouTube, it's your entire screen right now. So thank them for it not looking like terrible.
Actually, I do have a good episode photo I'm going to send you. That's...
Oh, excellent.
Chef's kiss. It's from the teaching game I did, and it's a destroyed 222 with a 25 pounder looking at it.
Awesome.
Yeah. And also, I guess, well, there's our staff. Eric, if they want to hear more of you, where can they find you?
Right now, if you want to hear more of me, nowhere, because my schedule has gone terribly wrong. Normally, in better circumstances, if you want to hear my voice doing more things, I am the co-host of the Lost to the Nails podcast. which is a podcast that is at this point best described as 40K adjacent. We have gone deep into heresy, deep into 8mm stuff. Both Brian Harvey, who used to be the host of Splintermind, and I have a little bit abandoned 40K for a while. We're letting it percolate. So that's normally where I can be found if you want to hear my voice. If you want to read my words, I post infrequently on my blog, Variance Hammer. That's at www.variancehammer.com. And as of probably a little bit after the show, but technically my first contribution has gone live, I am now one of the writers for Goonhammer's historical section. My first contribution to that was a brief introduction to the fictional short Selkie, the Irish heavy fighter, but I'm working on some actual articles about actual historicals for that. And we've got a bunch of stuff planned that I'm hoping to be involved in. I believe I am on there as Variance Hammer Eric right now. So that's our plugs. If you want to hear more of this show...
Well, I mean, that was your plugs.
That was my plugs. We're going to do our plugs, and then we're going to move to Calvin's plugs.
Okay, fine.
If you want to hear more of our show, join our Patreon. You will get no bonus episodes, but you do support the show and importantly help pay for Adrian. So hear the same number of shows, but better. That's at patreon.com. I believe it's /PlasticQuestGangPodcast. We'll have a link to it in the show notes. You also get access to our Discord, where you are welcome to ask questions, suggest show ideas, tell us we're wrong about everything we've said, all of those fun things that come along with Discord membership. Now, Calvin, you are extremely online. Where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter, where I post infrequently at Brushes and Jazz. And if you see my likes, okay, I'm not afraid of you. You can find me on Twitch at Nevermore Painting, where I paint toy soldiers and then click on heads in Apex Legends. Also, a fun thing from our Discord is we recently had a really fun discussion about Cold War Canadian armor with someone who, I believe, drove Canadian armor of that era.
We have discussions like that on Discord where we helped walk them through some things that were like, oh, you're looking for the M113, but the mortar version, which is the M150, that's hidden in the M113 box. You just don't glue some things together and then glue some other things together here. So yeah, if you want to participate with us, we are both extremely online. We're on Discord basically, like, because you get up earlier than me and I go to bed later than you. I think we have like close to 20 hours worth of coverage per day on Discord. And of course you are welcome to talk to us about ideas, brainstorm things. I'm always happy to come up with off the cuff army concepts. That is like one of my hobbies because it means I can come up with something and go neat and then not paint it. Whereas then Calvin goes neat and then paints it, and that's why I hate him.
Well, I mean, another thing is I'm good for, I've done this for actually for one of our other members of our club is, hey, I want to paint X thing quickly. And I can go, cool, here's how you can do that as quickly as possible. For example, like Candy Coat, Farsight. I'm like, cool, metal paints and contrast paints are your friends. Go nuts.
Yeah. Find the brightest chrome you can. Start there.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's our Patreon. That's how you can find us all. I'm on Twitter as well, as long as Twitter continues to exist, at @VarianceHammer. Thank you all for joining us for this episode, and we will see you next time.
Hopefully sooner.
Please, please sooner.